For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Evicted, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is expected to fight extradition to the U.S. on freedom of information grounds, but he may have trouble proving that.
The charge has to do with conspiracy to commit computer fraud and abuse. And so although his defense will try to make it appear as if he's being charged with publishing information, that's not at all what the charges are.
Also, an American parlayed her Italian roots to get EU status and move to the United Kingdom. Now people like her have a lot to lose with Brexit.
Nobody knows what's going on as far as our rights to live and work in the UK.
An American in England and much more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A weird scene in London this morning as police physically remove WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from Ecuador's embassy. In Assange's shadow, more than 700,000 documents, highly top secret information from the U.S. and other governments, things like video footage from Iraq in 2007 that implied the U.S. killed civilians and reporters there, or documents in which American diplomats called Vladimir Putin's Russia a virtual mafia state. And it was all published by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. The World's Matthew Bell joins me to cover the various angles to this stunning news. What happened today, Matthew?
London police went into the Ecuadorian embassy after the Ecuadorian government terminated Assange's asylum. They hauled him out. They shoved him into a police van. In video shot at the scene today, you can see Assange. He has a white beard. His hands are cuffed in front of him. He was shouting, "The UK must resist." He frankly looked a bit tired, a bit stunned. A few hours after the arrest, we learned that the U.S. unsealed an indictment against Assange, and now the U.S. is seeking to extradite him.
We're going to get to the indictment in a moment, but first of all, he was at Ecuador's embassy in London for 7 years. What suddenly changed that he got this diplomatic immunity yanked from him?
Ecuador's president made it clear this morning that Assange had worn out his welcome.
La conducta irrespetuosa y agresiva del señor Julian Assange.
President Lenin Moreno released a video statement and said that his government was terminating the asylum it granted Assange back in 2012, and that's because of his, quote, discourteous and aggressive behavior. Moreno went on to say that the founder of WikiLeaks violated an agreement not to meddle in the internal affairs of other countries while he was staying at the embassy, and that he was even threatening the Ecuadorian government. It's been reported, Marco, that there's more going on behind the scenes here. President Moreno and his wife were hacked, and then personal, embarrassing, and potentially even incriminating material was put out online for the public to see. Seems pretty clear that President Moreno blames WikiLeaks for playing a role here.
It gets a little confusing here. Assange is Australian. Apparently, he was connected to Russian hacking of American secrets, among other things. So why was he in Ecuador's embassy in London in the first place?
All right. I think we need to go back to 2010.
Just a few months ago, most people had never heard of a website called WikiLeaks or of its mysterious and eccentric founder, Julian Assange.
It was almost a decade ago that WikiLeaks grabbed global attention, as you already mentioned, for publishing these massive troves of classified information from the U.S. government. This stuff included military reports from Iraq and Afghanistan, along with thousands of diplomatic cables from American personnel all over the world. They thought they were writing in confidence. This was all classified.
So the dump came in 2010. What happened next?
I'm not sure Julian Assange was a household name at that point, but people starting to become more aware of WikiLeaks. Now, 2012, Assange is in the United Kingdom. He was facing charges of sexual assault in Sweden and possible extradition back to Sweden. At one point, he was granted bail, and this is when he went to the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Why? Because Julian Assange had struck up a friendly relationship with Ecuador's former president, Rafael Correa.
I thank President Correa for the courage he has shown in considering and in granting me political asylum.
Those sexual assault cases in Sweden were eventually dropped in 2017, but Assange remained in the embassy in London until today, and that's because he said all along that the United States wanted to arrest him.
The United States must renounce its witch hunt against WikiLeaks. The United States must vow that it will not seek to prosecute our staff or our supporters.
And now we have an indictment from the U.S. Department of Justice. So, Matthew, stick around while I turn to talk about that indictment with Carrie Cordero. She's a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Assange has long said, Carrie, that he feared being handed over to the U.S. for prosecution. Is his extradition now a slam dunk?
Well, it is a unusual case in that it's somebody who has been involved in the media world, but it's important to note that the charging document, the indictment that was filed in the Eastern District of Virginia in federal court, does not charge him with any crime related to publishing classified information. The charge has to do with conspiracy to commit computer fraud and abuse. And so although his defense will try to make this out to be a First Amendment case and try to make it appear as if he's being charged with publishing information, that's not at all what the charges are.
Why is that important, that he's not charged with publishing?
It's important because it is relevant to newspapers and media organizations for them to know that even if they are on the receiving end of classified information, which many national security journalists are involved in sometimes receiving classified information from individuals who work in governments and are in positions of trust, that they won't be prosecuted for simply publishing that information. What's different in this case, and it's the key difference, is that he's charged with actually helping Chelsea Manning, who was a Department of Defense employee, with cracking a code to be able to access Department of Defense systems. So the facts in the indictment include specific information about extra activity that he was engaged in that's not traditional media activity.
Carrie, Matthew here. Are you thinking of the possibility of other charges down the road? What's to stop the U.S. from charging Assange with other crimes?
Well, nothing's to stop them of doing it. And I'm very curious as to whether over time we will see more charges brought against him, not necessarily pertaining to Manning, but perhaps pertaining to other activities that Assange may have been involved in, assisting or conspiring to violate the computer fraud laws for other hacks. So, for example, the big question that many of us have on our mind is whether or not there would be any charge against him for involvement in the Russian government intelligence operation that hacked U.S. entities during the 2016 election. There's nothing about that in his current indictment, but I'm curious as to whether there might be in the future.
Why is there not an espionage charge here?
Well, espionage traditionally, and I think that's an important judgment that was made by the Justice Department, espionage is usually charged against somebody who is the individual in the government who is in the position of trust. So I think media organizations would be more concerned if there had been an espionage charge. It's a much cleaner case for the Justice Department to only charge him with conspiracy regarding violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Another thing, Carrie, that's been connected to this whole story is protecting free speech and the First Amendment. A line that Bruce Shapiro wrote in The Nation recently, he said, "If the First Amendment means anything, it is the right to obtain public interest information from impure, indeed hopelessly tainted sources." When you think about that, about the press freedom issues at stake here, what goes through your mind?
Well, certainly that is a part of this case. And I think that that's why, you know, the activity that's alleged took place in 2010. So there was significant debate, my understanding is, throughout the Obama administration as to whether or not he could be charged with something. And so this was a significant step for the Justice Department to decide to bring these charges. But I think that's why they chose to bring a narrow charge only related to the actual hacking activity. And there is a world of difference between legitimate journalistic enterprise when a journalist is on the receiving end of information, even if that's secret information or classified information, versus being an active participant in a conspiracy to conduct criminal activity.
Carrie, Donald Trump spoke about WikiLeaks often with admiration dozens of times on the campaign trail in 2016.
WikiLeaks! I love WikiLeaks!
Could that positive attitude have any impact on the treatment of Assange?
Well, it's interesting. I think the president was asked about that in the pool outside the White House, and he demurred and decided not to comment on feelings that he may have had about WikiLeaks, certainly throughout the 2016 campaign. And so he had a long track record that certainly was making concerning statements from the perspective of those of us who worked in the national security community. Clearly, it looks like this indictment that was brought in the extradition process is something that was handled by the Justice Department and law enforcement, completely separate from any influence from the White House, and that's how it should be.
That's Carrie Cordero with the Center for a New American Security. Matthew Bell, I remember our newsroom when WikiLeaks published in 2010, all those thousands of documents. It was unreal. And also just how transparent the world suddenly became overnight.
It was. And we had information from all of these diplomatic posts all over the world, not to mention that Assange really was seen by many people as a hero for exposing things like that helicopter attack in Iraq and operations in Afghanistan and other places. But the story arc of Assange here, obviously the story is not over. But as Carrie Cordero alluded to, I think there are a lot of unanswered questions. And when you read just the material that Robert Mueller has put out from that investigation, WikiLeaks sort of plays maybe not a starring role, but it's in there. And there are a lot of unanswered questions about the connections between WikiLeaks and the Russian interference in the 2016 election.
Well, we'll be carefully watching the next steps here. The World's Matthew Bell, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
For people who follow the court challenges to Roe versus Wade, big news for abortion rights activists in South Korea today. The country's constitutional court ruled that a ban on abortion there is unconstitutional. South Korea is one of the few developed countries to criminalize abortion. As my BBC colleague Laura Bicker reports, thousands of protesters had converged at the courthouse in Seoul expecting this ruling.
Huge landmark ruling outside the court. As I was there, there were a number of protesters from both sides, both pro-choice and pro-life. And there were tears on both sides as news of this ruling started rippling through the hundreds of crowds. Obviously, from those who are pro-choice, they were delighted. This is a day that they thought they'd never see. They've been fighting for a number of years now. And they see this as a kind of a landmark ruling for women's rights. There's a burgeoning kind of women's rights movement, feminist movement here in South Korea that's really taken hold. And this fight to overturn the ban on abortion has been part of it. The other side, those who are kind of pro, they say they're pro-life, there's a deeply conservative evangelical Christian base in South Korea, and they were there on behalf of many of those. They say they will continue to fight because this law is now in the hands of politicians who have until December 2020 to rewrite it. This is a law that's been in place for 66 years in South Korea, where if you have an abortion, you face a 2-year prison sentence or a hefty fine. And also any doctors seen or heard about carrying out these abortions could also be prosecuted. But despite these kind of restrictions, abortions are widely accessible in South Korea. They can be carried out safely. And women who end their pregnancies are rarely prosecuted. But I spoke to a number of women who have had abortions, and they say that the clinics that they did go to were pretty underground. They had to search them out. They knew, and the practitioner made them aware of the consequences, and they said there was a huge social stigma. In fact, one woman at the protest today said that this was the first time she'd even managed to tell anyone that she'd had an abortion. So I think what they believe, these campaigners believe, that this will allow women to safely carry out abortions. But again, it's now all in the hands of politicians who will write this law, and many are wondering whether it'll only be early term abortions, so maybe 1 to 12 weeks that will be allowed. But still, they're saying this is a landmark victory.
That's my BBC colleague, Laura Bicker, reporting there from Seoul. Coming up, an American who's got a lot at stake with Brexit. That's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Get your Brexit Halloween costumes ready. The European Union has granted the UK another extension, giving British politicians until, yes, the auspicious day of October 31st to sort out how, or at this point if, Brexit will become a reality. Here's EU Council President Donald Tusk.
This extension is as flexible as I expected and a little bit shorter than I expected, but it's still enough to find the best possible solution. Please do not waste this time.
Do not waste this time. Still to be seen if Britain's politicians will take that advice. Prime Minister Theresa May's government has ordered Parliament into a short recess. After that, they'll be back to try again.
So let's use the opportunity of the recess to reflect on the decisions that will have to be made swiftly on our return after Easter. And let us then resolve to find a way through this impasse.
It's been 3 years of uncertainty since the Brexit referendum passed. Among the people trying to make their own plans around Brexit, foreigners living in Britain. Sarah Micatel is an American expat living in the UK, thanks to her Italian citizenship. I asked her how she felt when she first heard the result of the Brexit vote in 2016.
I was heartbroken.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected.
I mean,
had you already moved to the UK at that point?
Oh, I have been in the UK since 2011.
Okay.
Yeah. So after I got my citizenship, I spent about a year in Italy. And I go back all the time. But for me, UK is home. I love it here. And it was devastating. We were all in tears.
Does it mean anything for you personally and your ability to stay in the UK?
Yes, there is a lot of confusion and angst amongst all of the Europeans here, and I feel European at heart, and I am a European now. Nobody knows what's going on as far as our rights to live and work in the UK post-Brexit. If Brexit happens, I still hope that it doesn't. One of the brilliant parts of the European Union is the freedom of movement, where EU citizens can pack up and move and live and work anywhere in the European Union.
A lot of confusion, then, around what your rights are as an EU citizen in the UK. But as for Brexit itself, how do you explain it to your American friends?
Oh, gosh. You know, we're still confused over here as to what's happening. But basically, if the UK leaves the European Union, there could be global economic ramifications, you know, throughout the world. But I also really think that a destabilized European Union means a less safe world for all of us. So that's what I explain. Like, that's what's at stake. It's not just, oh, the UK just wants to go and do its own thing and everything will be fine. I really think the European values that I hold so dear are at stake.
Brexit has been described as a huge embarrassment for Britain, as you know. Do you agree with that? I mean, has Brexit changed your opinion of the UK?
Oh, I would say it did lose a little bit of its spark for me. But I have to say that the people's marches that have been happening have completely brought it back. Being with hundreds of thousands of people who said, we voted on something, we had no idea what it was. Now that we have a better idea and we think it's going to be really bad for the UK and the European Union and the world at large, we want another shot. We want to vote again. And I really hope that happens.
Sarah Micatel, the host of the travel podcast Postcard Academy. Sarah is American and European and lives in the UK. Thanks very much, Sarah.
Thanks so much, Marco.
So one American there holding out hope the Brexit can be called off. There are many Americans, though, who have some trouble keeping focused on the regular back and forth over Brexit, raising my hand here, too. If you haven't been following the daily grind of Brexit negotiations, then stick around for the social upheaval. Friendships ended, harsh language exchanged, even stories of some marriages on the rocks. The country's political parties have also split up over Brexit. So in this feverish atmosphere, what do you think it's like to be a member of Parliament? Here's The World's Patrick Cox.
We may think we know about British politicians.
Try to calm down and behave like an adult. And if you can't, if it's beyond you, leave the chamber, get out.
OK, the House of Commons can sound like a kindergarten. But most of us also think of it as a venerable institution, a flagship for democracy, run by responsible people, producing laws for the common good. Well, we thought that until Brexit.
I have shouted at more of my colleagues and said things to them and used fruitier language than I normally use.
This is Conservative pro-Brexit Member of Parliament Andrew Percy.
Because I'm so frustrated by this whole thing. But I think it is having a mental health impact on so many colleagues. I mean, I think we're probably all, quite a few of us, would probably admit we're drinking more than we should do. You probably just think, well, I just need a glass of wine or a beer. And eating a bit more. And not sleeping as well.
Percy has fallen out with many in his own party. People he thought of as friends. He says he doesn't know if they'll ever patch things up. And things are hardly better across the political aisle. The main opposition party, Labour, also has its internal divisions, which may only deepen. Here's anti-Brexit Labour MP Anna Turley.
This is going to go on and on and on. We're not going to be done with Brexit for a very, very long time. The negotiating is just going to be beginning, the wrangling over the money, and that's what fills me with dread as someone who, you know, came in to do different things.
Like improving schools or healthcare or business opportunities. Nope, not a chance. Just all Brexit, all the time.
It's taken an emotional toll, and no one wants to be making decisions under pressure of feeling, well, I'm worried for my life, I'm worried for my family's life, I'm worried for my health, my well-being, my ability just to go down the shops and not feel under threat. I mean, I admit I've done that a couple of times myself. I've never had any abuse in the streets, but you do, just walking from a car to a car park, you find yourself looking around, making sure you're with people, because you've got the emails, because you've had the social media abuse, because, you know, we've had like someone come into the office and shout at my staff, and you start to, those things dominate.
They get in your head, Turley says, and they refuse to leave. Except when she walks into one particular room in the Parliament complex, a resting place. There are three of these rooms, in fact. Lady members' rooms.
No boys allowed. They're always a few degrees warmer than the rest of Parliament. There's usually like an ironing board. The odd MP has been known to lay on the bed and have a snooze. You never know who's going to be in there.
Maybe women from other political parties with other political beliefs. But all of them at their wits' end over Brexit and eager to talk about it.
Just about, you know, what politics should be about. Having a chat, human to human, isn't it awful? And actually it's a really nice little sanctuary to go away and hide from all the trauma.
Conservative Andrew Percy has his own hideaway.
There are some cubicles and they're in a bit where, and you can switch the lights off. It's just for a rest. I've even moved a little chair in. People stop outside and have conversations. I feel like I'm in sort of East Berlin in 1983. So it's great. It's a really good hiding spot.
A good hiding spot. That's what it's come to. Members of the British Parliament, the people who were elected to lead, that's what they're looking for right now. For everyone's sake, let's hope there's a happier life after Brexit. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
I'm Marco Werman. Big celebrations in Sudan as the country's longtime ruler is forced to step down.
It was a sense of shock, triumph, and joy, like, all at once. This is something that, like, I personally have never, like, thought was going to happen.
But also concern about Sudan's military now filling the void. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir was ousted and arrested today by the Sudanese military, a military that up until now had backed him ever since he seized power some 30 years ago. The defense minister says that Bashir's arrest comes with charges of corruption and poor management. The International Criminal Court also has a warrant out for his arrest, accusing Bashir of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Sudan's Darfur region. Bashir's removal follows months of deadly protests and a sit-in at the military headquarters. Today, when news of Bashir's arrest spread, celebrations roared across the capital, Khartoum. But those celebrations came to a halt quickly because the Sudanese military also announced that it would be in charge for up to 2 years. That is not what the protesters were looking for when they fought for regime change. Tigrid Abdin is one of those activists. She's been protesting since December and explains how today really went.
The past few days have been pretty hectic. Work has come to a complete standstill. Basic things like groceries and bank transactions, everything has stopped because everybody is at the sit-in. But since last December, we've been protesting. People have been on the streets demonstrating against the regime until what was the planned endgame, the military headquarters sit-in. There was a very distinct energy to the protests, and there was hope, so much hope. But everything took a very strange turn today after the statement that was issued by the military. So, no, it is not perceived as a good thing replacing one strong man with another. People are extremely frustrated and outraged at what is perceived as a hijacking of our revolution. Protests will continue. The people have stated very clearly that they do not accept this, the authority. And a lot of people are just brushing themselves off and continuing in defiance until this second attempt at a regime is removed also. I hope that we are successful as demonstrations continue and the military acknowledges that the people are not interested in cosmetic change. We want real change towards a democratic system. We didn't work this hard for the military just to come and occupy us for another 2 years.
That was Tigrid Abdin, an architect and activist in Khartoum, the Sudanese capital. And as Tigrid mentioned, the protesters are not done. They're incensed that the Sudanese military is effectively taking over the revolution they started and putting itself in charge. Rebecca Hamilton has kept her eye firmly on Sudan since 2010 as a journalist and also as a lawyer at the International Criminal Court. She now teaches law at American University. What is your understanding, Beck, of what led the Sudanese military to stage a coup and remove Omar al-Bashir and arrest him?
This has happened as the result of extraordinarily courageous protests by the Sudanese people. The latest iteration of these protests began back in December, and they have continued despite people being detained, tortured, and just faced a whole lot of other consequences for continuing their protests. But ultimately, the protests have become overwhelming, and it seems that Bashir saw the writing on the wall.
The fact that those protests were not stopped by the Sudanese military, what does that tell us about Bashir's relationship to the military?
Well, it's really interesting because Bashir has always had an extremely close relationship to the military, and that is one of the things that has enabled him to stay in power for this long. But I think the military saw, with just the strength of the protests and the breadth of the protests is the other thing. This was not just from a narrow section of the Sudanese population. It was really from across the whole country, saw that the protesters were just not going to accept Bashir staying in power. And I think that is why they have moved to take control. It should be noted, though, that they are taking control for themselves. This is not a transition to democracy. And the man who is currently in charge, the previous vice president, now in control of the Sudanese government, Omar Abin Auf, he himself has a lot of blood on his hands and is, in fact, sanctioned by the U.S. for atrocities in Darfur.
Let's put the current events on pause for a moment and go back and talk about Omar al-Bashir, the man. What's the thumbnail sketch on Bashir and his impact on Sudan?
What we've witnessed this morning is, in fact, the fifth military coup in Sudanese history since it gained independence from Britain back in 1956. And Bashir, who was in charge of the fourth military coup back in 1989, has managed to survive and retain control of this country for 30 years. And he's only been able to do this by being a very sophisticated political operator. For the longest time, he was able to use the wealth of the state to develop a patronage system, to manage to keep potential rivals happy enough. But in 2011, when South Sudan voted to become an independent nation, what they took with them was the vast oil revenues that Sudan had been using and that Bashir himself had been using to help keep himself in power. And since then, we've seen a decline in the Sudanese economy and Bashir losing the ability to maintain the patronage system that had helped him stay in power for so long.
So he survived his relationship with Osama bin Laden. He survived the heat he got for Darfur, but it was ultimately the economy, it sounds like what you're saying, that was his undoing.
I think it's coupling of the economy with just the sheer courage of the protesters. In addition to obviously being able to develop this patronage system, the other mechanism that he had was not only the military, but the brutal and feared security services in Sudan that are known for just detaining people for any sign of opposition against the government, for any sign of protest, and routinely torturing dissidents.
So Sudan is at a strange impasse. On the one hand, Omar al-Bashir is out, but the defense minister has now declared a 3-month state of emergency and imposed a curfew. What does this mean for the arrival of democracy, which is what brought the protesters into the streets in the first place?
The protesters are not satisfied by these developments. Obviously, they're an incredible first step, and everyone is heartened by that. But this is not what people have been protesting for. They are looking for a transition to true democracy, and military rule is not that. History here does not give us a lot of encouragement. When we look at the past military coups, there was back in 1985 a transitional military government that for once in Sudanese history did allow democratic elections. And so in 1986, we had a democratically elected president, but it was actually the military coup led by Omar al-Bashir in 1989 that took power from that democratically elected president. I think one of the challenges for listeners to understand is that this is not just about who is the individual in charge of Sudan. Sudan's real challenge and what the protesters have been fighting for is for a state that will actually represent all the citizens of Sudan. And that is the goal here, a true democracy where it doesn't matter whether you come from Darfur or Blue Nile or the Nuba Mountains. If you are Sudanese, the state should represent you. And that is going to be a longer struggle than simply the replacement of Omar al-Bashir.
Rebecca Hamilton teaches law at American University. She's been following Sudan closely since 2010. These events have riveted Sudanese people living outside the country. Haifa Abu Sheba, among them, she's a 16-year-old Sudanese-American who lives near San Francisco, and she's been captivated by what's been happening in Sudan these past few months. We managed to catch up with her at school in between classes and got her reaction to today's news.
It was a sense of shock, triumph, and joy, like, all at once. This is something that, like, I don't think I personally have never, like, thought was going to happen somehow. Like, we kept saying the chance of al-Bashir to ICC and just fall, that's all. And then so when it just actually happens, you have this sense of, like, patriotism and nationalism, and you just joy. And it's so surreal. You're just in the moment. You just can't, like, go of it.
So a sense of triumph, did you feel that you were kind of, even from a distance, part of the protests in Khartoum? Have you maybe even been doing your own protests at home?
Yeah, of course. No, yeah, like going to the Bay Area and SF a couple of weeks ago, having our speeches, having our meetings in our local organization building, those things that we do, keeping my friends that aren't Sudanese knowing and updated about this makes me feel like I have done as much as I can my part.
Yeah. So who are you able to share this excitement with? Like non-Sudanese, you said, I mean, what do they make of it?
I started talking about it when I came back from Sudan from my trip in December, and it wasn't as big as it is now. So it was a couple of videos there, a couple of like messages there. But the bigger it got, the more I would walk into my government class and like tell my teacher and tell my friends. And from then on, they just became hooked themselves, and they would keep up with like themselves. They would go to websites, go to accounts. So me telling my friends raises more awareness to what's happening.
And what about other Sudanese Americans? You said they're in the Bay Area. You've got a small network. When you talk about the future now in Sudan, what is it that you and younger Sudanese are hoping comes out of the end of this long chapter of Omar al-Bashir?
I think we all want a democracy. We want our home. We want our country back. I feel like many of us, like me, we feel like we don't belong. Even though we're in America, we have a house. We feel like our home is Sudan, and we've been away from it for so long. And I think this revolution makes us feel more like, no, this is our home. And him getting arrested and him not being president anymore makes you feel like there could be hope that we can go back to our home country and live, and our grandchildren will live there, and our children will live there.
Do you plan to go back to Sudan anytime soon? I mean, what did this moment today, this historic moment, mean for like your own future?
It changes my future completely. I remember for college, I wanted to go to Canada or Dubai and study political science, international relations. But after what happened, I most likely will go to Sudan, study political science or international relations there. And if democracy does occur, try to hold office myself, try to be involved in politics in Sudan, because I never thought this would happen 2 years ago or even 5 months ago. So it happening now just makes me feel like I can go back to my country and I can do something. And I remember the minute it happened, I called my friend in Fremont. I was like, we're booking a ticket, right? Like, we're going in June, right? Yeah.
Wow. So the news today basically has changed your life.
Basically. Mm-hmm.
So when you went back to Khartoum in December, were you taking part in the protests?
Unfortunately, I couldn't because my parents were scared. They feared for my safety. I remember we would drive by protesters and you see protesters on your right, and then the army with semi-automatic guns and like trucks and stuff ready to beat them. So my mom was just like, you're not going out there. You're like, don't go. But I tried as much as I can, but my family wouldn't just let me. So that was really just upsetting. But yeah.
Have you spoken with your parents today? And did you tell them, hey, you should have let me out in the streets. I could have made history.
I said that. That's exactly what I said. I said, you see, like,
really?
4 months ago, I would have been out there. But there she was like, no, your safety and everything.
Well, we're glad you're safe. Haifa Abusheba, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a great day, guys.
Haifa Abusheba is a Sudanese-American teenager in California, reacting there to the ouster of Omar al-Bashir, who was president of Sudan for 29 years. India's general election got underway today, first day of voting in a process that will stretch all the way to May 23rd. That's when the final results are expected. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP, are hoping to win a second term in office. Their main opposition is coming from the Congress Party, led by Rahul Gandhi. To give you a sense of what's at stake, have a listen to this thorough little guide prepared by our partners at the BBC. Ready? Here we go.
Why is it a big deal?
It's a huge election. 1 million polling stations for around 900 million voters. India's economy is ranked the sixth biggest in the world, and its democracy is the globe's largest.
There's some key things on voters' minds. The economy.
It's still growing, but it has lost momentum. Many farmers have debt, small businesses are struggling, exports have dropped, and unemployment has risen. The BJP's promising direct cash to farmers and waivers of loans. Congress is offering a minimum income for the poor.
Women.
More women are likely to vote than men for the first time. Some parties are offering education loans, free cooking gas cylinders, and bikes for girls.
National security.
Tensions remain high with neighbouring Pakistan, especially over Kashmir. Both countries are nuclear armed, but which party will be stronger on defence and which is more likely to guarantee peace?
Wow. Okay. Don't worry about committing it all to memory. You've got more than a month to figure it all out. One of the editors guiding the BBC's election coverage in India is Divya Arya. She says it's daunting to cover a vote that's taking place over more than a month. And an election that, as we heard a minute ago, involves an estimated 900 million eligible voters.
So there are seven phases in which voting will happen. And it's not as if particular states go to vote at one date, in one phase. Most states are spread out across phases, which means that at any given point of time, there can be 7 or 8 or 10 or 20, as is the case today, states that are going to vote. India is really many countries in one country. So we do want to represent what different voters' concerns are. And especially when we have a conflict-ridden north in the state of Kashmir, or the eastern states which have a Maoist insurgency going on. The southern states sometimes say that we feel like a separate country because our issues are very different from the way the people who live in the north may be concerned with. Unemployment is not as rampant as it is in the north, for example. So we do want to represent each part of the country and the concerns. So that again becomes a guiding light as to how we deploy ourselves.
That's the BBC's Divya Arya in Delhi. Final results in India's long general election are expected, as I said, on May 23rd. Okay, with all the big heavy news today, how about a fish story? A marine mammal story, to be precise. It's a good one. Last month, a 51-year-old wildlife photographer was in the water off the coast of Port Elizabeth in South Africa. His goal? To document a whale feeding on sardines. But something extraordinary happened as he did that. He ended up inside the whale's mouth. And he explained how that happened to the BBC's Neil Rizel.
I'm Rainer Skimpf. I'm 51 years. I live in Port Elizabeth. I'm a dive tour operator, film crew production manager, and we do whale watching.
For two decades, he's been documenting the wonders in the waters off the Eastern Cape. The most spectacular of all is the sardine run.
It's the biggest migration of marine animals in the southern hemisphere.
Billions of sardines flash and swirl as they migrate north. Their vast numbers create a feeding frenzy. Sharks,
seals,
birds,
dolphins, and whales
all feast on sardines. Sardines respond to these attacks by bunching together into dense swarms called bait balls. To the untrained eye, it appears to be a kind of glorious chaos.
Outsiders, it might appear to be chaos. It's dynamic, but it's yet still very pretty to look at, and I wouldn't really describe it as a chaos. It's amazing to watch.
And he's still saying that, even after watching up close for 20 years.
As you know, we work in the open ocean, and any scenario is possible.
He says that, but it's hard to imagine he could have predicted a scenario earlier this year. He was filming the sardine run from the water at a distance.
We are accepted in the water, but we are not part of it. So animals swim past, and it's almost like they ignore you. They are after the fish, and we are after the pictures.
So there he is, in the water, in the midst of this frenzy.
I got in the water with two security snorkelers, and we started filming the sharks, and out of a sudden, it got suddenly very dark.
And he felt pressure on his hips.
It's about the pressure of a strong hug, not more.
He'd never experienced anything like it. Squeezed in the darkness, his mind raced. What could do this? Was it an animal? There were a lot about. Then, in a flash, he thought, I'm still conscious. It can only be one thing.
It's a baleen whale.
Rainer Schimpf was in the mouth of a whale.
They don't have teeth, fortunately. Otherwise, we wouldn't really talk, I guess.
It had accidentally caught him while feasting on sardines.
So it was very dark. I couldn't see, smell, or hear anything in there.
In that brief moment when you were in the whale's mouth, did you think, what if it dives?
Well, yes. That was my second thought after realizing that it cannot swallow me because its throat is not designed the way that it can swallow a human. My second thought was that it might dive, so I was holding my breath.
These whales, I mean, if it had dived to the bottom with you in its mouth, how deep do they go? How long do they dive?
Well, at this area where we were, it was about 80 meters deep, so it would have not be a very pleasant experience to go down that far.
That's an understatement. He would have died. Do you feel its tongue? Are you able to move? Are you being crushed? What's that like?
Well, I was holding on to my camera. I had a mask on and a snorkel, and since the whale closed his mouth pretty much, I could not see anything because it was black, and I had in 2 seconds no time to play around and feel his tongue or whatever. He realized his mistake, and I got out. I was obviously a bit confused, but unharmed. The whale swam away fine with a stomach full of fish.
And Rainer had a mind full of questions. Fortunately, a colleague caught a photo of the fateful moment, It's incredible. The whale's head is out of the water, and Rainer's bum and legs are hanging out of the side of his mouth, like a wet cigar.
I had the sense of what happened, but to visualize how I actually looked inside the whale, there was no imagination in my head how it could actually be looking. Only later, when I checked the photos, I realized what had happened.
And what did you think when you saw that photo?
That I'm a lucky guy.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. Do you think your life was in danger at any point?
Well, put it this way. A whale's head easily weighs up to 3 tons. Only if you put that into relation to a car, if you park a car on your foot or on your hip, it can easily crush you. It just proves how gentle this particular whale was and how sensitive and sensible he was with myself. I got out, the whale got his food, and it's kind of a happy ending.
The photo has now been viewed by people around the world.
This has to be an unprecedented picture. Take a look. There, the jaws of a whale, and there, the legs and flippers of a man dangling. Now, this guy is a nature...
Well, I don't know what the definition of celebrity is, but yes, I've had a lot of cold calls from the Americans, from South America, from Africa, obviously, Europe, Australia, and the only continent missing is Antarctica.
Not surprisingly, his story drew quick comparisons with the biblical Jonah, sometimes translated as Jonas, who was swallowed by a big fish in a storm. More surprisingly, Rainer has a son called Jonas.
Well, we had two options, Philip or Jonas, and when I saw him, I thought, ah, that's a Jonas.
Rainer's using the spotlight to draw attention to one of the big threats to marine life everywhere, plastics. Do you think that it was at all dangerous for the whale?
It would have been had I been a plastic bag, because it would have been more difficult for the whale to actually spit me out. He probably would have ended up swallowing me as a plastic bag and dying.
After the whale spat him out, Rainer returned to his boat, caught his breath, then got right back in the water to film the wild glory of the sardine run.
I mean, I love my job and I converted my hobby to be my job, so I seriously enjoy it and adore it, and it's amazing.
Wow. Wildlife photographer Rainer Skimpf in South Africa. He shared his story of ending up in the mouth of a whale with the BBC's Neil Rozelle. Before we leave you on this busy news day, a quick recap of the top stories. Julian Assange, the controversial founder of WikiLeaks, was hauled out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London this morning by police. He'd lived inside the embassy for 7 years while trying to avoid extradition. The U.S. says Assange conspired to publish classified military and State Department documents through WikiLeaks. Assange's lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, spoke outside the courthouse in London today.
We will be fighting extradition, and he'll be brought before the court again within the next month.
And the big news out of Sudan. The president who ruled the country for 29 years is no longer in power after weeks of protests. Omar al-Bashir was forced out by Sudan's military today. Bashir is the second longtime ruler in the region to be forced out by protesters this month, the other being Algeria's Abdelaziz Bouteflika. One of our favorite satirists, Carl Sharrow, tweeted today, "Arab Spring Season 9 is not bad at all." From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.